I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey hustlers, we know that this 2024, the entrepreneurial journey is filled with challenges. An often overlooked aspect is the time-consuming task of processing payroll and managing government requirements. And did you know that the average admin spends a whopping 50 hours per month dealing with just government compliance? That's time you could be spending on growing your business, or let's be honest, taking a well-deserved break. But fear not, we got a game changer for you, introducing Sprout Solutions and their tailored solutions for MSMEs called the Payroll Starter. With Sprout Solutions Payroll Starter, you can finally reclaim your time and get your life back on track. Say goodbye to the stress of remembering tax dates or worrying about missed payroll runs. This bundle is designed to make your life easier and your business more efficient. And here's the best part. The cost starts just at 5,000 pesos per month for businesses with up to 10 employees. Yep, you heard that right. That's just 5,000 pesos per month. So why spend another minute drowning in payroll paperwork when Sprout can revolutionize the way you manage your payroll and government requirements? Take the first step towards a more efficient business today. Visit sprout.ph/payrollstartermonthly5k. If you missed that, don't worry. We have it in the description box of this episode. So click that too. And again, big shout out to Sprout Solutions because your time is too valuable to be spent on paperwork. Reclaim it with their Payroll Starter. Now let's begin this episode.
The Hustle Share podcast is brought to you by PDAX. PDAX is a homegrown cryptocurrency exchange that offers the best rates among local cryptocurrency exchanges. Download the PDAX app now on the Google Play Store, App Store, or Huawei App Gallery. Start trading Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other cryptocurrencies for as low as 50 pesos by signing up on podlink.co/hustleshare PDAX. Also powered by PodMachine, the simplest way to grow and edit your podcast. Sign up now at podmachine.com and use the code HustleShare to get one free edit.
I see a lot of female founders like say no before they even try it because like pattern matching is real. Like you look at who are the successful people, you look at one generation above you, what, how many female founders there are.
Welcome to HustleShare, the podcast that features the daily grinds of unique hustlers around the world to show not our differences, but that our hustles are very much alike. Now here is your host, Ronster Baitiong.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Share Podcast. We finally got the girls. There's one thing that I'm very, very proud of, right? Every single company that have been to YC from the Philippines, I've interviewed, except one. This is my time stone right here, all right? In the gauntlet of all YC Filipino companies, finally, I get my final stone to create the whole Infinity Gauntlet. And again, without further ado, let's welcome to the show Camille Ang and Jiawen Tang of Hive Health. Show girls, how are you?
Good. I still remember this was your first line when we first met in one of the startup events.
I am trying to be Thanos. So far, I now have it all. I will snap everyone into YC oblivion. Just kidding. Again, welcome to the show. I've been wanting to have you guys to join, but you've been the hardest to reach until I bumped into you into the Sendit event. Shout out Sendit again for inviting us over to that event. We're very, very happy to be here. But again, I need to ask you, girls, the million-dollar question. Girls, what's your hustle?
Okay, so we do Hive Health. Hive Health provides higher value, easier to use health plans for small, medium businesses in the Philippines. So we do this through our simplified digital platform, care coordination, and dynamic risk underwriting.
That is such a pro answer. I love that. Okay. And again, Hive Health has been part of last year's YC batch. I've had the newest one also, Shipmates, back when before they were even Shipmates. And I still remember having Josh in Devo in the studio, this literal studio that I'm in back then. So I'm still okay with the gauntlet. Let's see. We'll catch up with Josh and Devo soon. But girls, I need you to buckle up real quick, because before we even talk about Hive Health and the amazing stuff you do, we need to understand your origin story. So I need you to buckle up. This is a 7-seater because we're going to have to ride the Hustle Share time machine.
Let's do it.
All the way to Ivy League territory. Alrighty. Okay. So, yeah, I'm very, very curious because Camila and Jawan, I've been really doing a little bit of background research because at least I want to have context I have had on the show. So, again, first thing I see is that you guys are both Ivy Leaguers. Okay. So, I was like, what the fuck? That is amazing. Right. And I want to start first before we even talk about your experience in Harvard and all in Stanford and. Yeah, both Harvard. I want to understand first your origin stories growing up. How did you guys get into tech or at least hustling in business? Was there any influence growing up? I'll start with you, Jawan. Am I pronouncing this correct? Is it Jawan? Jawan? Well, I don't want to butcher any name.
No, thanks for asking. It's Jawan.
Jawan. Okay, got it.
Unless you speak Chinese, then it's Jawan.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, but for me, I actually don't come from a family with a lot of business background. And so it's really from my upbringing as a first generation immigrant to the US. So I was born in China and moved to the States when I was young. And so I think a lot of my hustling was watching my parents do, I think, the ultimate hustle, which is uproot their entire lives. Wow. As adults, move with a young, probably mischievous kid to a new country where they didn't really speak the language, and watch them build a middle-class upbringing for myself and for my younger brother. And I think that's where a lot of my motivation for paying forward the opportunities that I've gotten in life to really now see if we can expand access to really enabling other people to live the kind of lives that they want to live. And healthcare is such a key part of enabling that.
That is amazing. Now, I want to just ask real quick, because I've heard this from a lot of Asian Americans growing up, first generation, second generation, third generation, that there are stereotypes. There's a bamboo ceiling of some sort. But sometimes that also starts at home, especially from Asian parents that are very, very, say, obsessed with meritocracy, right? And how you're like, okay, you need to be an engineer, and you know, they stereotype you. Was there any such pressure when you grew up in the States?
I think my parents were actually pretty odd and an outlier in that sense. I didn't have tiger parents, like helicopter parents. I credit that to a lot of my exploration career-wise. I think they wanted me to make sure that I can support myself and do something that I believe in and that I enjoy doing. And those were the only two criteria. So number one is having to support myself and not being financially dependent on other people. And then after that, it's a free-for-all.
Okay, now let's talk about school. So correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm just literally basing it off of your LinkedIn. Which came first? So you did obviously Columbia. Oh my God, like I can even just imagine what it takes to get into these prestigious schools. But walk me through, is it Columbia that you went through first?
Yeah, I did Columbia in undergrad. Studied economics and political science there.
So that's a mouthful right there. Well, I can see like, oh yeah, Philippines, we're from UST, La Salle, whatever. But we're talking about the best of the best in the world. And I like talking and asking people about this, for especially their experience, because again, there's, first of all, you don't get to meet a lot of people from this side of the world that have been to schools like this. What was that like doing Columbia and then eventually going Stanford and Harvard? And I think you guys met in Harvard, correct me if I'm wrong, but
yeah,
let's start first with your origin story. Hustling in the Ivy League before y'all came up and met each other in Harvard. What was that like?
Yeah, Columbia was really incredible and eye-opening in the sense that you can imagine I'm transplant to Rhode Island, grew up in the smallest state in the U.S., very suburban. And then all of a sudden I'm in New York City. And I think Columbia was really a place where I got to explore and open my eyes about what is beyond my borders beyond, you know, the confines of a small community or even within a state or in the US. And that's where I first learned about development economics. First time I actually traveled outside of the US.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a lot of like exploring, a lot of student, the typical college experience, a lot of student activities and clubs. Actually, funny enough, I wasn't actually involved in the entrepreneurship club back in college, around the Asian American community advocacy and Model UN. I was a huge Model UN nerd in college.
Wow. That's amazing. But last question before we go to Camille. I want to understand real quick, was there, during this process of going to Columbia, and again, you mentioned you weren't into entrepreneurship yet, was there a chip on your shoulder? Because again, we all know that sometimes also the parents of immigrants and children of immigrants have that chip in their shoulder that, again, they want to have a better life because, again, U.S. is perceived as a land of opportunity. It's easier said than done to thrive in there. But majority of the time, people come there to hustle and, you know, live the American dream. Was there a chip on your shoulder growing up, going through all these, you know, great schools and studying hard?
Yeah, I think for me, it was, I don't know if it's a chip or, yeah, definitely there's a lot of self-imposed pressure to be a maximizer, to maximize the opportunities that have, be part of X many clubs or do X, Y, Z. I do think in college, the mindset was there was a very predefined version of success to do, you know, consulting in these predefined tracks. And I think me back in college, didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to just make the most of the opportunities that I had. And what I was aware of back then was management consulting. And actually that's where I got first exposed to FinTech and a lot of like data science methods. And I really don't regret doing consulting before I tried entrepreneurship. So I'm a big believer that I think all of our experiences are cumulative. But I do think it did take a lot of exploring for me to then kind of step back and realize like, what is my North Star and what is it that I want to like focus in on. So yeah, I think the pressure was to make sure I covered a lot of ground and tried a lot of different things. So if you're looking at my LinkedIn, that's probably why it's a lot of the very diverse experiences that are
that's
now.
That's amazing. Again, amazing journey. And again, no wonder you guys thrive, but okay, I'll go to the other side. But before we start, let me just express gratitude real quick because it wasn't a rumor. Yeah, I was just at all. I was with my founder friends last week. His name is Dexter Ligot Gordon of Swarm, formerly of Caliber. He said that, you know what? There's this an amazing YC founder right now who you need to look out for. And she wrote the TNVS law. I'm like, what? So okay, you guys,
part of the team when that
No, she said she wrote the TNVS law. If you guys are not familiar with the TNVS law, the reason why it's so much easier for you guys to book fucking cars in this country using Grab back then when there was Uber, especially during those years where, you know, it was sort of like in a gray area because the government didn't understand how to classify that. We owe it to this girl. Okay, so let's just give roses where roses are due. So Camille, she wrote that law. So okay, now we are on the right path. So Camille, amazing job. Thank you. But at least now we can book freaking cars without worrying about being pulled over by some random dude as well. But let's now start with your origin story. Ika. Okay, you're an Ika girl.
Wow. I'm not sure where you pulled that, but wow.
I am a professional stalker. Well, walk me through growing up. Again, all-girls school, Chinese upbringing. Was there any exposure to entrepreneurship here while you were growing up?
Yeah. I think first, I was part of a team. I'm not the one who passed the law.
Not passed the law, but you wrote the damn law, according to Dexter. There you go.
But yeah, in terms of my first exposure to entrepreneurship, it was really growing up in a community of family businesses, especially being in ICA, seeing how everyone hustled and how much impact it can bring. So I think that's when I told myself in the long term, I do want to create an impactful business. And when I went to undergrad, I got involved in the social entrepreneurship side of Gawit Kalinga, heavily involved there.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. It's giving me flashbacks. Yes.
That's what this podcast does, okay? That's why we go to the time machine, all right? We go back.
With the sound effects.
Right, exactly. Exactly. What did GK teach you? Because I remember having the daughter, the founder of GK, Anna Melotto Wilk, who told us that it was such a formative experience in really understanding what the plight of normal Filipinos doing that volunteerism work that's really impacts communities. What was that like for you?
Yeah, I think that was the first time I saw that it's possible for business to solve social needs directly. I think growing up, a lot of people think that it's you build a big business, employ people, and then give back in terms of philanthropy later. That was the only model I knew.
Right.
Obviously, like these businesses also provide a certain need, but then GK was targeting the need first before they built their businesses.
Right.
And I was very inspired by that. But after that, I was looking for something with scale. I remember I went to the Ateneo Immersion Program and saw how bad infrastructure was in the Philippines, really crafted my entire career path in terms of public-private partnerships. So after graduation, did public-private partnerships with McKinsey. It's a consulting firm for a short stint. And then an undersecretary from government stole me.
Stole you? What no, a nice thing to
join
steal.
Government for 2 months.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, 2 months left. I was like, okay, I want to see the pain points. But when I got there, I really realized how government is a tool to create structural change. So work in the transport side, my first project was actually the Cebu, Mactan Cebu Airport. And I was like, wow. Because I remember going to the office and seeing so many feasibility studies in the shelf, but that was never done. But it was like the time in Philippine history where, hey, I'm a fresh grad who knows nothing.
You thought you knew nothing, but you were not Jon Snow. Okay, there you go.
But I was like, wow, like because of this public-private partnership framework, so many projects were done. And these are projects that solve needs that the government was supposed to do. But because the government and business came together, we were able to do something much bigger.
Correct. That project is literally just one of many PPP projects, especially two administrations ago, right? That's where it started out. You know, your Skyway Stage 3. Everything that you see thought that's technically build was technically done prior to that. I'm just fact-checking these things because sometimes, you know, you can get lost in translation. Like, oh my God, thank you to the administration. And by the way, you don't owe anything. We don't owe this to our government. We don't owe a debt of gratitude because this is why they're supposed to be there anyway. They charge you taxes so that they can create infrastructure or any type of stuff. This is what we voted them for. We don't owe them shit, right? And the beauty of it is now you have private excellence that comes in and it gets things faster, done faster. Of course, there's still some, you know, things that you have to overcome that's systematically wrong in there. But in the grand scheme of things, it's faster. Sorry, I'm just passionate about this because we have to put facts in here. Right? Where if there's some people that we need to put gratitude for, it's people who are in the private sector that actually got this done. Because if it was just pure government, man, it's still going to be a different thing. But okay, I'll just jump back real quick. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly. I just wanted to double down on your point. I think like from the private sector, sometimes people look at people in the corporate as like, oh, it's evil corporate. But that actually like, it does a lot. And that's the reason also why I went to private equity for most of my career to understand the private sector side. Okay.
Before we talk about PE later, because I literally just learned about PE when I studied how to be a VC a few months ago, but I'll just go back to also Joanne, because there's one thing that is also a common denominator between two of you guys is that, again, you sort of work in government. But holy shit, Joanne's experience is holy. It's amazing. So you've done IMF, World Bank, and the United Nations. I've never met anyone who's worked for those amazing institutions around the world. And again, literally ticked all those boxes. What was that? That's like real quickly. What was it like working in the United Nations, the World Bank, and IMF? And what did that teach you, Joanne?
Those were all not planned. I think that's one thing that we want to convey is that, you know, what you see on LinkedIn or resume might look intimidating or fancy, but it really was, I think for us, we've very much been driven by like what we're interested in, like being very much North Star mission first. So wasn't ticking a box or planning it, but from, I think similar to Camille, like I wanted the experience of understanding how institutions work.
Mm.
We all know about World Bank, IMF, World UN, because they are such large players in the development space and
right.
facilitating public-private partnerships. So I would say the IMF and World Bank were more on the research side. So that was really around like data science and emerging markets, thinking about digital development. The UN mm-hmm. was really interesting. I was in the internal strategy group for the Secretary General. So that was much more like operational thinking, looking at a very bird's eye view, thinking about the interconnections across nations and,
yeah.
and thinking beyond just like the economics side. That's mm-hmm. what our the Harvard program we were in. It was also thinking about like real issues around like natural disasters and crisis management. And it, I think it helped me think a lot more like interdisciplinarily at multi-levels of how do we interact and what are the stakeholders you have to bring around the table.
Right. And again, that's common now. Now that sets the precedent here. You've been in similar situations from the Philippines here, PPP, but like global things. You've seen how, again, institutions work. Sometimes the bureaucracy that involves that revolves around in it. But overall, the goal is to bring good to the world. And that's where I believe in, because by default, those institutions are built to really solve problems, not to just make red tape or make things super complicated and whatnot. All right. Now, before we take our last break, let me just ask Camille one quick question. So you mentioned that you also was working in PE at the Macquarie Group. So one thing that I've learned, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is just me being an idiot and being a naive guy, is that I thought before PE and VC are very similar. But to an oversimplified version that I've learned when I studied in Insignia Ventures Academy, definitely not your Harvards of the world, but just how I gave me an understanding of how VCs look at deals at startups. A PE, the multiple that they look at, they're happy to have a 3 to 5x multiple of an exit, but the check sizes are holy shit, like a $20 million check as a baseline. Where in VC is high risk, high reward, they're looking for 100x multiple, lower check, but super high risk. Is that correct or an oversimplified version? Please educate me. I'm just being an idiot. I just want to understand from someone who worked in PE, especially in Macquarie, what type of deals were you guys looking at and what were you guys looking to fund?
Yeah, I think broadly that's correct. Macquarie private equity was specifically focused on infrastructure, real estate, public-private partnerships. It was interesting because that was the first time I also got exposed to private equity and the first time that the country was ever investment grade enough for private equity firms to look at the Philippines. So it was like an
interesting. Oh, those were the days. We're back in the dump. We're back down in hell again. But back then, no, we were investment grade. My goodness.
Okay. We are still. And
we
I
are
think
still. Okay,
everyone
perfect.
Looking at the okay. Philippines. I was actually surprised being abroad and everyone, non-Filipinos even, have been looking at the Philippines for opportunity for impact and creating businesses. But to your question, I think broadly speaking, that's correct. Most of the time, like VCs look at earlier stage companies. So it's about the team,
yep.
What the idea is, how big the market is. On private equity side, it's a lot of things that are all like businesses that are already built. Yep. Either secondary, it's a resale, or you're building it from scratch, but then, you know, like a solar plant, like, you yes. know, business model works already. Mm-hmm. And I think both serve an important part of the economy. Right. And they're generally in the same bucket.
Exactly. It's just, if you just sum it up, the main difference is just risk appetite and check size on how they look at it. Because I looked around, it's like, holy shit, I thought all the deals that, say, the Sunicorns got here in the Philippines. I call them Sunicorns because they're about to be unicorns or not. They're quite Series B, Series C. I thought all the deals were all VC deals. Apparently, they're all not. Some of the guys raised PE. And it requires a certain level of threshold for you to raise PE money. Because first of all, no PE will touch you if you're in the red. Correct me if I'm wrong, right? Because you're trying to scale. That's growth money already. If you're in the red, if you're burning cash, VC is your only way. All right. Wow. I learned something new. I got it correctly. That is amazing. All right. Now let's take our first break. And when we come back, let's now talk about Harvard and how you guys met and all the way to how you created Hive Health. But let's talk about that more after the break.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey guys, I have a very, very exciting opportunity I want to share with you guys. If you're a B2B startup founder, listen up. Your ticket to growth is here. Introducing Impact 24, the Philippines' largest B2B SaaS challenge. Calling all startups in their pre-launch, pre-seed, or seed stages, this is your chance to accelerate your growth. Submit your pitch to Impact 24 and get ready for a 10-week intensive program to elevate your solution. What's in it for you? How about up to 500,000 pesos in MVP project support, exclusive credits from industry partners, personalized mentoring, and a shot to pitch at SaaSCon PH, the country's biggest SaaS conference this April. But yo, you gotta hurry up because submissions close on January 26, 2024 already. Don't miss out on this opportunity to take your startup to new heights. Apply now at saaschallenge.ph. That's saaschallenge.ph. And good luck, and I'll see you guys in Impact 24. And we're back from the break. We are still with the amazing girls. Oh my God, I've never seen such a team. Now I understand why they got to YC. Just looking at it in paper, I'm like, holy shit. These guys are amazing. But let's now talk about how you guys met. All right. So again, had amazing such paths separately. But let's talk about Harvard MBA. How did you guys meet there? And walk me through how you eventually thought of doing Hive Health.
Yeah, so we actually met at the admit weekends of our various dual degree programs. So we're trying to decide what to go do. So we both decided to do the development economics MPA IV program at the Harvard Kennedy School. And we actually became friends a lot longer than before we actually decided to do the startup.
Wow.
And I think we just really bonded because as we just discussed, and we had somewhat parallel experiences around wanting to do more public-private partnerships. And we both came to grad school with the goal of doing something entrepreneurial, something mission-driven, and solving a critical emerging market issue.
That's great. So you guys were friends. You had similar, again, I think it was fit like a glove. You had similar background. When did the idea of Hive Health come? Is this pre-YC or you did this during YC already?
Yeah, this was definitely pre-YFC, right in the middle of COVID chaos in
college.
And we didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we both came to grad school to create a mission-driven venture for emerging markets. And COVID really opened our eyes to a lot of that. We chose the space of Hive Health because both of us came from really backgrounds where any health shock can wipe out one's savings here in the Philippines, you know, in China, even in the US. Mm-hmm. And personally, from my own experience, I have had a lot of family, friends, colleagues who you won't hear it in public, but then because of a health shock, it would like really cause strain in the family, get them into debt, wipe out their savings. And on a personal level, I've actually done this myself for my second mom, my yaya, when she got breast cancer. It was already stressful for all of us. And then I had to go through all the paperwork of claiming insurance, and it was terrible. And
not fun.
I can only imagine other people who can't pay out of pocket for what's not there is going through all this hassle, and you don't know anyone to ask, to go there to ask like what the process should be to be fully covered for your health shock. And
yeah,
I think that's the genesis of it. And we saw the big gap from the Philippines versus the rest of the world in terms of how much healthcare innovation can still happen here. Being in Boston, the healthcare capital of the world,
I think
that difference was very stark.
Can you just paint that picture? Because you said that there is a wide chasm that we're talking about of how the status quo is here in the Philippines versus status quo of how it's supposed to be in the world. Because I understand, right? Coming from experience, there's no shortage of people who's trying to educate people to invest in their futures through insurance. The problem is when it's being sold as an investment vehicle plus insurance, insurance comes, again, the last versus investment first. Where in reality, your primary goal should be really, it's inevitable, right? You know, everybody will have to go through a health crisis at one point. It's not a if, it's a when. Right. And right now I'm sort of like not in the thick of it. I'm starting to feel shit that I've never felt before in my body. Like, oh, okay, this hurts. I'm upset about this works. And I would be totally broke if I didn't have at least HMO from my company. I'm fortunate I have that ability and my family's covered. But how many Filipinos don't have that luxury, right? Especially if it's coming from, you know, a lesser known institution. And again, claims are a pain in the ass. But before we talk about that, how different is it? How wide is the chasm?
Can I'll you describe let Alan it? Yeah. Go for it, since I still remember when she asked me, like, wait, this is how insurance works in the Philippines?
Yes.
I was like, yeah, isn't it how it should be?
Correct.
Okay, I'll let John go for that.
Yeah, we're excited about this question because we spent a lot of time studying it on the academic side too. Like, this is what we wrote our master's thesis on. Mm-hmm. And so we think about healthcare coverage in three pillars. There's what is actually the population covered, okay, what medical services are covered, and then the financial coverage. And so if you look at it from a population perspective, Philippines is really interesting in that there is, in theory, universal health care in the sense that there's a national payer. I think that's like a very interesting structure. Yeah, PhilHealth.
Before somebody sold billions of pesos.
Oh my God. From an institution, from a structural perspective, I think that actually, you know, from like the different frameworks we looked at, having a national payer, I think there is a lot of opportunity to build on that. But as we know from PhilHealth, it's really focused on inpatient coverage instead of outpatient. And so a lot of the preventive care, a lot of the primary care that you need isn't covered yet through PhilHealth. You know, there's UHC implementation and that's exciting, but from a services perspective, it's quite limited to inpatient care and there are caps.
Yes.
And the financial coverage, I mean, we've done a lot of research on this, and you know, over 50% of healthcare costs in the Philippines are paid out of pocket. That's 50 episodes. And a lot of it is because outpatient care, medicines, a lot of things that for me growing up in the US felt like fundamental, like core part, essential parts of a healthcare plan weren't covered. And additionally, the way that insurance is structured here, it's everything has a maximum benefit liability cap or annual limit cap. Whereas if you think about it, insurance is supposed to insure you for the unexpected, and it should cover things beyond a certain amount. So the way that we're trying to change that through Hive is doing it incrementally, since we know that healthcare is super complicated and you can't change it overnight, but it's really along these three dimensions. And then we added a fourth dimension. So it's around increasing the population covered. So less than 10% of Filipinos have access to private healthcare like HMOs. So can we expand that to SME, the dependents of employees? That's around population. Wow. And services, it's covering things like preventive, mental health, medicine, and outpatient care. And then financially, we're trying to be super sulit in our plans and making it more value for money care so that, you know, that every peso that you're spending or that the employer is spending, it's going towards actually taking care of the members. And then the fourth dimension is around accessibility.
Yeah.
You can have the first three, but if the technology and the usability is not there, then that becomes a barrier to actually enabling someone to use their health plan.
You haven't even told me the product yet. I'm already sold. Right? It's like, where do I throw my money? I'm just trying to freaking show.
But that's kind of how we thought about it from like a macro systems perspective. Right. Because, you know, if we're going to spend all this time, all these late nights hustling on our venture, we wanted it to be something that at least had the potential to chip away or be incremental to systems change.
No, that's true. And in that said, if you really look at it, there's a really massive problem that we see because status quo doesn't work. Or if it does, it only serves a few. And if it does serve, again, you're right, there's a cap, right? And when you're sick, you don't really go, wait, I can only get sick to this level because beyond this, I'm not covered. So it's a double whammy when it happens because all of a sudden, the first thing that you should be really thinking about is how to get better. But as those things stockpile, that's why if you look into like general hospitals or like the PGHs of the world and whatnot, the best doctors are there, but also most of the people there are not covered by anything. And that they resort to, you know, charity sometimes just to get there. I don't know if you've ever gotten the chance to check out PCSO.
Actually gone through that as well.
Dude, it's so heartbreaking just to be able to get a little bit more help. You're already sick and you see all these people and you feel like it's not the best environment out there. It's hot. It's in the middle of nowhere. Just to be able to get a little bit of help or aid. It's just dehumanizing. That's how I would describe it. But how did you now see that problem and literally decide to create a startup around it?
So as I mentioned, I was in the middle of the pandemic. I think it was summer. And we were ideating on actually a multiple emerging market issues. And this is where I think of our third iteration. And there was a Stanford startup competition where 5,000 applicants were there. And we just like, well, let's try it. Why not? It's idea stage anyway. We were stuck in our rooms.
Mm-hmm. That was the first all-nighter we pulled for us creating our pitch video and the little presentation for the Stanford Embark.
Yeah. The funny thing is we changed ideas. It was a 3-month program or a summer long program. We changed ideas, I think, a week before the presentation.
Wow.
So we're like, whatever, let's just try.
This is reminiscent of Bay Mongo's journey. I think Francis pitched in last minute to apply in YC. And then he got in and everybody else followed after that. But how did that happen? 1 week prior.
Yeah, and we pitched and they said like, oh, you were, they only choose like top 11, I think. And we were part of it. We were showcased. We're like, what happened? It's like, oh, okay.
Well, what did you guys put in there? Because you can't be making that cut. It's not a fluke. You must have said something great and you must have done something amazing for you to make the cut. What do you think was it?
I think the problem was real, right? We touched a bit about it, but we can go on the whole day about
healthcare. We have the whole day.
Yeah. And the opportunity is real as well. Like Philippines, we're a rising middle class. COVID is creating more digitization. COVID is also creating better awareness for the need for quality health plans. Mm-hmm. And it was the why now. It was a sliver in time where actually like a venture can create tremendous impact, but also like a tremendous economic value.
Got and it. Now when that happened, all right, you got in, when did it start becoming real? Right, all right, we have something here. Because a lot of people would pitch, but there's a big gap between pitch or wanting, we're becoming a wantrepreneur to becoming an entrepreneur, right? And when you make that jump, there's no turning back. How did you guys make that jump and say, all right, let's do this shit?
There's a very specific week in April 2021 where it's very real. So after we got the first Stanford showcase, we're like, okay, let's do some more customer discovery, do a lot of interviewing, prototyping. And we ended up applying to the Harvard Business School New Venture Competition. So this is the competition at school.
I was a fangirl because I knew that that was a competition that launched Anthony Tan's company Grab.
Yep.
And it was called MyTaxi that time. And they were the only Southeast Asian company that I knew of that won that global competition. And because of that, he was able to launch Grab. So that was... like I was a fangirl to even be qualified to join that competition. But
wow.
Our mantra is like, just try. Wala namang mawawala.
Okay, hopefully we can make the top 10. And then it's like, why don't we make the top 10? It's like, oh, hopefully we can make the top 4. So our the company
just like the Miss Universe. Like, okay, if I make the cut, let's go. I'll just go for the win. You had none to lose, right? So
So it was like I think it was a Tuesday. We were one of the code grand prize winners of that competition. And
what?
That same night is the night that we got notified that we had an interview for YC. And so then we spent, I think, like 48 hours to prepare for our YC interview. They were scrambling.
Are you kidding me?
And then waiting up all night to, and then we got the call from the YC partner.
Okay, so like within walk me through. That was a blur.
Yeah.
You were supposed to do
that. The window was like, okay, things are getting real. People believe in our idea, and we have the resources to actually like bring this to life.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing is we did a lot of interviews from both employers and employees, and that's really, I mean, the awards are great, right? But then at the end of the day, what gave us conviction was speaking to employees, employers, Filipinos, regulators, realizing that this problem that we know of is a like economy-wide problem was really encouraging. I mean, ideas can change. A lot of people in YC are pre-product market fit, but like that was really our
anchor. The problem was real.
You know that you really identified a problem because I now understand, because it's really rare that people get this much support and conviction at idea phase. But you've done this before in your previous hustles, that you know how to identify the real pain points, quantify them, and really explain them that right down to the T, right? And then show it. Now the question is getting funding. Obviously, hindsight being 2020, you got into YC, right? But walk me through that experience of YC, because I know the standard. Once you get in, people think that getting in is the hardest part. I think talking to so many people have been there before, getting in is the easy part. Hustling to that 5 to 7, I don't know what's the standard that they told you of the week on week growth that they want, is the hardest thing. And pressure is on pressure on pressure. Walk me through that journey over the weeks that you guys were in YC, and what did you guys build? Because at the end of the day, it's Team Tam Traction. You had Team Tam Traction, something you had to work on. What was that like?
Yeah, I think there's two sets of challenges that we faced. And one is like more maybe internal, thinking about like a founder side, and then the second is actually, yeah, to your point, like getting traction, launching, and really making progress. I think on the first set, I think for Kimmel and me, and we're first time founders from a venture backed company sense, and we were surprised to get in, and we realized that we were in the very very small minority of female founders, and I think there are very very few, and you know, one of our batchmates here in the Philippines, Maddie's, is I think the only like all women founder team that we know of. And so I remember logging into Zoom, and you have windows and windows of male founders. I think that's like a systemic challenge, or that's something I think as a female founder, that's something that we had to overcome and had to like step up to not be, to recognize that you're in the minority, but not let that stop you from still going after what you want.
Right.
So I think that's a lot of like the internal challenge of processing that in this very intense pressure cooker environment of YC, where you have these week on week goals. I think for us, it was really defining how to focus on a week to week basis. Mm-hmm. So, and at the stage that we were at, it's a lot with insurance, there are high barriers to entry. And so we were solving for what were the biggest risks for our company. And it wasn't necessarily the revenue growth, and it was really all the complexities of insurance, right? Like the regulatory, the licensing, the underwriting, and so forth.
And what were those metrics you were chasing? Because at the end of the day, you can't be saying week on week growth without pegging it to a certain metric. Or again, if you hit a wall, what were the pivots that you guys had to do in order to chase the right metric?
Yeah, metrics wise, so we weren't actually operational yet that time. So it was a lot of solving the regulatory aspect, creating a network of providers. So now we have close to 2,000 clinics and hospitals.
What? Are you kidding?
Like 3,000 doctors locations. So it was like building the blocks and being able to like make sure that when we launch,
every single patient is given the proper care that right. they need. Obviously, this problem is systemic, so we're trying to solve things like one at a time. Mm-hmm. And the partners have been very supportive. Actually, one of our partners is the CEO of YC, Michael Siebel.
Amazing.
And I was just like, oh my God. But then he's
gives a lot of tough love.
Dude, he talks about it in YC school. I watch his videos all the time.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm fanboy. I'm getting starstruck. I haven't gotten a chance to freaking talk about him. But
on the point about metrics, Michael was the one who actually advised us around, you know, really focusing. It was really around like learning how to focus on what is the right goal for your startup at that time. And for some companies, yes, it might be revenue, month-on-month growth targets. But then for us, it was around what will be the thing that would de-risk Hive the most. And actually shifting from like, our target shouldn't be a month-on-month metric. And actually it's around the other hard rocks we need to solve for first and making sure that we are making the progress that we want to on a weekly basis. And if we're not, taking a hard look and a hard assessment on why, and then trying to iterate and improve the next week.
Now, what were those hardest stumbling blocks that you had to overcome? Because again, you're not going to get it right. And startups are designed for you to iterate and navigate your way. It's like piecing through a puzzle and you don't even know how the end goal of the puzzle looks like, right? It's piece by piece. There's going to be a lot of pivots that you're going to have to do. There's going to be a lot of days where like, what the hell did we just do? Where are we now? What were those hardest ones that you remember and how did you overcome them?
I think the first one was getting our first customer.
There you go.
So after you build all the pieces, tested your product out, like getting your first paying customer was interesting. It's like, who you?
especially with healthcare, it's really about, our pitch is really around trust. And in healthcare, it's all about like, it's a promise that you will deliver. And especially, I think that's one of the challenges is being a startup, not having necessarily the reputation or the brand that a lot of existing insurers have. Like, how can we demonstrate that we are credible and that we will actually deliver a better experience for their employees?
Yeah.
And that was really hard, and learning how to say it in a way that resonates. Like, we had we built the product, we knew the research, we knew what things they wanted, but saying in a way that actually resonates with the key decision makers.
Yeah. And I think we're very deliberate about balancing growth and making sure the product is sticky and it really solves the problem. So we built a lot of additional product features before we took on our next few customers. And it's very encouraging to hear our customers say that it was a great bet. We're a data-driven company, so we always get feedback. So seeing the returns of that today is very encouraging.
All right. Couple of questions before we take our last break. Michael Siebel is a main proponent of PG's do things that don't scale, right? What were those things that did not scale that you have to do to get the ball rolling?
Oh my God, a lot.
We're still doing things that don't scale. on the first customer point, we actually drove through a typhoon rainstorm to on site to the first customer.
Where?
Get them to sign.
Near the airport.
Near the airport.
Oh my God.
Mention who the
customer was, but yeah, it's just, I think we got lost on the way. We're like, no, we need to get to them because we wanted, there's like this close to signing and we needed to just talk to the team to understand like what was the thing that we needed to address to get them over the finish line. And I wouldn't say we don't drive to all our customers now, but
especially not through a typhoon.
I mean, even like now, we have our fancy onboarding and like approvals. That time, literally, we were like speaking to them like one by one and like getting Google Sheets for feedback.
Right.
Sometimes doing the like approval, like simulating the patient experience that we want, but it was really like us doing it. I mean, now it's like automated,
we also do a lot of, we do a lot of like mystery shopping testing of our providers.
Mm. Yeah. Like yesterday we were.
Yeah, I'll go to the hospitals and clinics and, you know, I mean, I have my own Hive plan too. So I just bring the see how
undercover boss style. There you go.
We're just experiencing the pain points firsthand, right? Too, right?
And yeah, that time we were sleeping at 5 a.m. in the morning because we were following like
PSC
time. Yeah. And we were sharing the same bed because we're bootstrapped.
Wow.
And just
we
like
spent a lot of time together.
and that's true. And that's what it takes. And that people always think, oh my God, they made it to YC. Their life must be super, super nice now. Hell no. Right? You get here, you get yourself into probably one of the hardest things you'll ever have to do. And there's no guarantee of success. Right? And that's what, again, mad respect to you guys for such an amazing journey. But last question before we take our first break. It can't just be the two of you, right? If you're building tech, who else did you have on the band or on the crew to make an amazing team? Because now from ideation to doing things that don't scale, you got to get a couple more people to get in, especially when you get a little bit more funding coming from YC.
Yeah, so on the tech side, actually, I built the full product. I still lead the tech and the product and operations. Mm-hmm. Camille, you know, she does a lot of the business development and
legal
finance, all the fun,
all the others,
all the fun,
cleaning the office.
Oh my God.
Getting us company snacks.
We have other key team members that we have.
We have people from backgrounds from the medical field, startup, SME, and like
growth operations.
I think one thing that ties everyone is key qualification is like passion for innovation in healthcare and what we're solving. We've gone through like a couple of folks who have like stellar experience, but if the bottom line isn't there, it's going to be hard for the long run and culture fit. So yeah, very grateful for a team.
But I want to understand, because again, you're right, they might have the skill set on paper, but how do you find that trait in them come interview, and how do you qualify them when they get in? Like, all right, we got the right people on the boat, because it's important, especially if you're building a team. And this is the hardest thing, because your team will evolve over time. Sorry, I'm sounding like an old fart here. You know, the rule of 3 and 10, I don't know if you've ever heard of that. When your team multiplies in multiples of 3s and 10s, everything breaks. Mm-hmm. And sometimes who's on the boat will have to change as well. That, oh, this guy was really amazing for us in 1 to 10, but at 10 to 30, not the right guy anymore. We're going to have to naturally have to, either they'll find their way out and whatnot. And that can be painful. But from this very start, how did you find the right people to get on the boat?
I think we're very transparent. Like when we ask like what their goals are for the next X years, what matters to them, like in working with us, and it becomes clear. So if it's not a fit, then it's not a fit. But we're very, very lucky to be surrounded, not just by like the core team, but you know, other partners, like all the folks who supported us in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And even like, yeah, government, there's a lot of like bright spots that are wanting to solve this problem.
How young is the team? What's the age range of the people working with you, right?
20s to 30s.
Perfect. All right. So right in the not too old, not too young generation. But it's a blend of millennials and Gen Z, old Gen Zs. There you go. All right. Now let's take our last break. And when we come back, let's feed forward. I'm going to ask you some amazing questions. And of course, paint the picture of what Hive Health is going to do when you guys go full blast in changing this industry that is due for real disruption. But let's talk about that more after the break. Hey Hustlers, it's time to talk business once again, and we're excited to share a bit more info about our sponsor, Sprout Solutions. And again, just like what I said at the start of the episode, you should check out Sprout's Payroll Starter as you grow your own startup, because this bundle that they have is literally what you need to take your startup to the next level as you grow your employees. And this bundle is your key to freedom, including payroll outsourcing to experts, a subscription to timekeeping and attendance software, and government compliance services. Sprout's Payroll Starter
Charter has you covered for payroll, BIR, SSS, and taxes. All the stuff that no founder loves to do. So let Sprout handle the busy work and say goodbye to lines and tax payment stress. All this for as low as 5,000 pesos. Again, that's just 5,000 pesos all in for your payroll and HR needs. So visit sprout.eh, payroll-starter-monthly-5k, or again, just click the link in the description box of this episode to elevate your business management game. And again, big thank you to Sprout Solutions, liberating your time for what truly matters. Hey hustlers, wish there was an easy way to open a bank account and grow your money without the hassle of lengthy application process and income documents? Well, I got good news, because today's sponsor, Uno Digital Bank, is here to help you achieve your financial goals. You can easily open an account with the Uno app in just 5 minutes and one valid ID. And as one of the 6 digital banks licensed by the Banco Central ng Pilipinas, the company is committed to providing customers with simpler, better, and more accessible banking. Last year, Uno Bank was recognized by the Asia Banking and Finance Awards and bagged the title Open Banking Initiative of the Year due to the success of its partnership with GCash, one of the Philippines' leading mobile wallet platforms. And with the Uno mobile app, you can access an hashtag Uno Ready Savings account and enjoy daily interest crediting. With their hashtag Uno Earn or hashtag Uno Boost Time Deposit accounts, you can enjoy a high interest rate of up to 6.5% per annum. Enjoy monthly payouts with hashtag Uno Earn and flexible tenors with hashtag Uno Boost. Other app features include pay bills, the Uno Virtual Debit MasterCard, life insurance, scan and pay with QRPH, and phones. And the one thing that I really love about Uno Digital Bank is they're open to collaborate with a lot of Filipino startups. I've had a chance to see the partnerships that they've had lined up with the startups that they have, and it's truly exciting to see how a digital bank like Uno can enable startups to unlock the power of fintech through digital banking. So if you're ready to elevate your banking experience, download the Uno mobile app today from the Google Play Store or App Store. Or if you want to collaborate with them, I'll be happy to give you an intro. Just shoot us an email at hello@huffleshare.com. Hey hustlers, I hope you're having a great 2024 so far. As you know, a lot of startups had a very challenging 2023, and hopefully things are going to do better this year for a lot of us. Not just because it's the year of the dragon, but also because our sponsor, DragonPay, is here to help your startups process payments in the most efficient way. Established in 2010, DragonPay empowers businesses of all sizes to accept and disburse payments through secure and convenient channels, giving your customers the flexibility to choose the payment method that suits them best. With over 85 partner channels, 35,000 partner branches nationwide, including QRPH, e-wallets, crypto, buy now, pay later, and many more. They also process an astonishing 15 million transactions processed globally each month. DragonPay is your trusted choice for online payments. And here's something to show you how legit DragonPay is. DragonPay was named Fintech of the Year at last year's Philippine Fintech Festival in 2020. So let's make 2024 extra prosperous for you and your startup in this year of the dragon. For more details, head on over to dragonpay.ph. That's dragonpay.ph. Trust the pioneer. Trust DragonPay. And we're back in the break. We are still with Camille and Jawen, who then told us how they were able to hustle through YC. But now walk me through after YC. What was that like? So now you're off into the wild after demo day. Was it fundraising galore all of a sudden, or is it like customer acquisition? Because that's something that's a little abstract and it's different from team to team. What was that like for you after demo day?
So we did a little bit of fundraising after the YC batch, but we really then doubled down on product. And for us, I think securing that first set of customers and getting people to trust that we are providing health plans, I think we felt a large responsibility to make sure we don't screw up. Like with healthcare, it's not like a game app where if something breaks, it's okay. You just launch a new release. For healthcare, we wanted to make sure that we got all the process from front to end really, really right and new every little detail of that patient journey. And so we invested a lot of time in product development. And when I say product, it's not just the tech, but also understanding all the process efficiencies and applying tech to then streamline it.
No, I was going to say it's only like now that we're like, we can take a little more small, medium businesses and excited to also like start growing the team. We've been very lean and very excited now to take on our next batch of small, medium businesses that we can grow with and also build a team to help us out.
I'm curious about one thing about for Rajawan. So obviously, you're now here. Are you guys back here or are you still are you back in the States?
Yeah, we're sitting in Manila.
Okay, cool. Because sometimes I get confused, like, hey, there's sunlight, but 9 p.m. sometimes in the East Coast, and like, there's still.
But nothing changes because we sleep Manila time.
Ah, okay. All right. No, I want to understand though, what was that like for you, Jawen, when you now saw the problem in person when you started to move here with Camille, right? Because again, I'm pretty sure you've been here before, right? But moving in full time and having to acclimate yourself here, when you really get to see this more frequently, how does that affect product development?
Yeah, I think it's really key to get feedback with any kind of product development cycle. Any feedback is a gift, and meeting the customers or the patients, our stakeholders where they are is really, really critical for that. So actually, for instance, yesterday just came back from a day of field visits to different hospitals and doing the mystery shopping that I was saying. But from I think from like a livability or like transition perspective, I actually think Manila feels very comfortable for me. It's similar to like other parts of Asia I've lived in. I've actually spent time living in Swaziland and Africa, which is much more rural than Manila. So it's really great to be here.
She's also learning new phrases.
Oh, there you go. I told her sipon earlier because
give us a sample, Colin.
Like Habana hair.
Oh, Habana hair. The important phrases that matter.
There you go. Or pare. Or astig. Do you know what astig means?
Oh, I haven't taught her that yet.
It's cool, technically. Awesome. There you go. But I want to understand, you guys were talking about feedback. And this is where I see a lot of startups kind of mess it up. I think sometimes when you ask for feedback and it's a little misleading and you're leading people to a certain answer, it doesn't really solve the problem for you. But from what you've learned, how do you get the right feedback that's going to be useful in your product development and iteration?
A lot of what we do is very hypothesis driven. Because I'm building this feature because I think this will solve this problem for the patient. And so if I see that the problem is still happening or they're not using the feature, then clearly there's something wrong in what I thought, and there's a gap between what is expected and what actually happened. And so first is being very hypothesis driven. I think second is being creative about the ways that we are asking for feedback. We don't want people to get like survey fatigue and you're always out. What is your NPS score? Tell me your NPS score.
I mean, we do end up for NPS score.
We do ask for NPS as part of it, but they're varying the ways that we do ask for feedback. Like, you know, sometimes we'll actually go, you know, we do a coordination on annual physical exam. So we'll sometimes go to the clinic where the patient is. We kind of try to embed ourselves into what they're doing so that they're not doing a lot of extra effort. Like, you want to make it really easy for people to provide feedback.
And I think asking open-ended and non-leading questions is quite important. Sometimes you assume your customer thinks the same.
Yes.
Being open-ended is like really helpful.
And you get a lot of qualitative answers on that one too.
Yeah. Right?
Because when you do survey, multiple choice, then you're leading into something and then you're not really able to do it. And of course, the biggest resource here is time. You have to spend a lot of time trying to get the right feedback in order for you to get quality feedback that will be useful for your iterations as well. But now I want to ask something about coping. And I don't really get to talk to a lot of founders this way, especially, you know, there is still stigma that people think that, oh, the startup life is all about, you know, the parties, the drinks in a rooftop bar and whatnot. But the flip side is this shit's hard as hell, right? It's really hard. But how do you guys cope during those those downtimes. Unfortunately for us founders too, you don't have the luxury of staying down there for a long time. You have to be the one to bounce us back first, because the team follows your movements, right? How did you guys cope with those downtimes where all hope can seem lost sometimes?
I think if this is a tip for going to be founders, choosing a problem that you deeply care about is first and foremost, no matter what happens, even if like curveballs come your way, I think that's rock solid. And then second, I think, is really surrounding yourself with people that can support you through the journey. So
right.
We're very lucky to have communities here in the Philippines, but also like other founders from Stanford, Harvard, YC, that are building a lot of amazing things. And also a lot of founders in emerging markets that face similar problems that we have.
Right.
Yeah, I would just also add that, I think we mentioned like, Camille and I spend a lot of time with each other. And so choosing your co-founder, if you choose to have a co-founder, I think that it's choosing the co-founder, but also you have to put work effort into maintaining that relationship. Like, and like setting aside time to talk about the hard things, the difficult things, and having an like, open communication channel. And that's something that we've also learned through the process, is how to communicate with each other and really listen to what we each need and figure out how best to support each other from not just like the tactical like business responsibilities, but really like two or three levels deeper about, to your point, like the really hard days and the hard challenges.
I guess personally also like taking a break. Sunday is the Sabbath for me. And it's easy to just hustle 365 days a year.
It's not sustainable though.
But when, you know, there are things that are like not immediate, but are important, like family, for example, your friends, relationships, taking care of yourself and being able to like reflect. For me, like I go to church, even if it's online every Sunday, that's kind of like my vehicle to be able to like reflect and taking a pause. Also allows you to think of your problem differently. Sometimes you're so immersed into one way of thinking, and a lot of creative juices comes from like uprooting yourself in a different environment as well. So taking that rest that you need is like helpful.
Right. You got to fill your cup.
I need to preach myself this too.
There you go. Yeah, that's true. And again, Dalton Caldwell and Michael Seibel talks about this a lot, that, you know, one of the mistakes a lot of founders in YC do is when they get office hours with them, they talk about the tactics and all that, but what they really like to look forward to is the human component of it, of the how are you doing as a founder, how are you coping and all that stuff, because those are the things that is very, very unique and hard to teach outside of what you do in videos. Because, you know, learning about default dead, default alive, fundraising, all that stuff, you can actually learn that on YouTube, right? And that's why I've learned. I've never been to YC, but I spend a lot of time watching their shit. But it's the human component of how to cope, because this shit's hard. Right. And even sometimes when you have the right people and the right team who has so much chemistry with you that understand it, that you support you, it's still hard. Right. And that's why you need to surround yourself with people that will be with you through and through, because they understand the hustle. And again, the best people that would understand that are also people who have been there, done that. Founders like us who are crazy enough to take this on. But I want to dabble into a topic, guys, because I've again seen you lately hanging out the super women of the startup industry with Raya, who I just had here on the show several weeks ago. But talk to us about the lack of female founders in the ecosystem in the Philippines. What do you see now that have changed? So I've seen that there's some massive change now. Successful founders like you, like Mikey of Mad Eats, and a lot more like Kim Yao, also Ika, I think, of Claudit, what do you see now, and how can we continue to help female founders to thrive in this ecosystem?
Yeah, like one part is like really the mindset. I see a lot of female founders like say no before they even try, because like pattern matching is real. Like you look at who are the successful people, you look at one generation above you, how many female founders there are, and it can be discouraging.
Yep.
But seeing a role model and like a number of those at that, I think Philippines is still
at an early stage really helps. So to the extent that like female founders can mentor others or like just share their story, I think that's very helpful. And then I think in the workplace, I think there are more tactical things. I remember in HBS, there was a respondent who would talk about how to empower females. You know, like being a mom is real, even if you say 50-50. We have a lot of friends who are doing egg freezing. We've been toying around that idea, you know, like with like benefits as well, but still like having the workplace be like accommodating for females and allowing females to take risks when historically generations before us haven't is very important. And I think it's generational, right? Like,
yeah,
my great-grandmother was the first one in her generation to have even an education. Her feet were still bound so that she's home. Yeah. And like the next generation was able to improve on that. Like, I hope I was able to build on that as well. And yeah, it's, I feel like it's not yet perfect, but the extent that we can support each other, both male and female.
Yeah, I was going to add to that. It's, I think there's a lot that women and female founders can do to empower and support each other. So like a SoGal group that Raya organizes is a really empowering group of community support, but it's not going to, like the system isn't going to change if it's only 50% of the population working to change it, right? Like, I think we really need allies and sponsors and supporters from male founders, like everyone in the ecosystem, to be aware that yes, this is a problem and you're losing out on talent because there isn't enough funnel or people are dropping out of the process before they, or they're not even giving the opportunity. And this, you know, applies across the, from the founder perspective, from the VC fundraising perspective. There's been a lot of studies around like unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. And so I think there, it needs to be like an active effort, and really appreciate you, Ron, bringing this up as a topic in this podcast to, you know, so that the listeners can be aware of it and think about what are the things you can do on a daily basis or in your role to enable more gender equity.
Absolutely. And again, we're I've seen a massive shift. And Camille, you're right. It's generational. Like, I literally, it is a sausage party sometimes. Like, what the hell? Where, why is this like this, right? But now I've seen more diversity. And, you know, one of the catalysts of really supporting startups is Ms. Eliza Gokongwei, who is a power angel, right? And again, very, very supportive of the women empowerment and, you know, women founder movement in here. So it's getting there. And I think if among, in our region, I think we're probably one of the most primed countries to make that shift quicker because the cultural boundaries are not as repressive as the other cultures that we have here. All right, last question before we now talk about Hive Health. Fundraising. Okay, here we go. The hardest part. How's that for you guys during YC and after YC?
There are multiple schools of thoughts, and I think with all advice, take it with a grain of salt because people come from different backgrounds. But
yep.
I think having strong partners for fundraising is really important. Those who, it's kind of like the team criteria we had, those who buy in the, like the vision of what you want to go for. Mm-hmm. YC obviously was like very helpful with that, but we have a lot of like angels who have supported us. And when we raised, literally the next day, everything was closed because they've been supporting us. And
wow.
Like, you know, like it was a relationship, right? They are part of the journey, definitely. And we're very early stage, a lot of things to learn still. Having them have your back is important.
That is amazing. All right. Now let's talk about Hive Health, right? Products here. What let's talk about it from a user perspective. What should people look out for? You said you've got 2,000 suppliers now, but what have you guys built that are exciting? That people should look out for?
Yeah, we actually have, so the 2,000 suppliers is hospitals and clinics, but we have 20,000 doctors across various locations.
Ooh-wee! Wow.
So I think the way that you think about it is there's the core traditional HMO benefits. So, you know, the full provider network, you know, we're on par with the other established HMOs. As well as the key, I think the essential benefits around outpatient, inpatient, emergency, et cetera. And then there's additionally a lot more exclusive high benefits that we've added. And I think about it from like the benefits perspective as well as the ease of use. So on the benefits side, I think we mentioned before, we're innovating on what to add in the plan. So things like mental health sessions, outpatient medicine, and we actually do our in-house video teleconsults that are unlimited for all our members. Nice. And that's across primary care, mental health, as well as additional specialists that we're launching. And so those are on the benefit side. And then in terms of the actual ease of use, we've built a very, what we think is a very streamlined and transparent, easy to use platform where you know, members can, the idea is we are empowering our patients to take care of their own health, to be proactive in taking preventive health measures. So we coordinate annual physical exams for everyone and they have all their medical records in stored centrally in one single app that they can reference and use. And we also help coordinate their care journey. So you're not having to bounce around to, you know, five different specialists. You can actually book a teleconsult with us. We do the intake and then we help you navigate the healthcare system.
Yeah, I think there are probably some listeners here who've never used an HMO because it was not transparent. One of our founders actually like said he has used four different HMOs, never used it because it would like he didn't know how to use it. And also like when he tried to use it, it was too difficult. Like the basic HMO story is you line up in a hospital for at least an hour just to get a piece of paper. You go to your doctor. And then after that, if your doctor tells you get a blood test or get something else, you go back that same line and then do that again. The whole day is gone.
I literally just did that a couple of days ago. So it's painful. Ouch. There you go.
But yeah, like from the SME side, there's a lot of frictions as well. Onboarding, offboarding takes time. Like when you call customer service, it's out of reach. And a lot of it is because of legacy systems that have been built through the years. We're very lucky to try to start from scratch. And that's the first thing that we tried to solve for. So now you could do online approvals. You go straight to your doctor. You go straight to your lab test. When you call customer service or reach out to us, we're there. But then what we realized after that is how weak the primary care function here in the Philippines is. I mean, I'm guilty of this growing up. If we have four different symptoms, we go to four different specialists and we don't get care until like something is like really there. So what we tried to do was build this like in-house teleconsult that like really knows the whole picture of your healthcare so that, you know, your employees could go directly without even getting a pre-approval, and we're able to invest heavily in primary care, triage, preventive care so that we avoid a lot of the longer term illnesses that usually happens when you don't invest in primary care.
That is so amazing. Again, thank you very much, Jawen and Camille. But before I let you go, where do people go? And if they want to work with you, if they want to buy or if they want to use this as their primary HMO now, they're sold like me. Where do they go and how do they reach out to you?
Yeah. So our website is ourhivehealth.com. So that's OUR and then hivehealth.com. We are actually going to post some like LinkedIn posts for potential hires. And we haven't published that yet, but watch out for that. And if you're interested, you're an SME, curious, we do even at a minimum of like three employees.
Wow.
If you're not yet regularized or contractual, you could email letschat@ourhivehealth.com.
There you go. Again, thank you very much, Jawen and Camille. But before I let you go, follow us on whatever podcast app you're listening to, whether it's Apple or Spotify or any podcast app. And if you see a 5-star rating, give us a 5-star. Makes us incentivized to keep doing amazing interviews like this. But also, if they did say some jargon, don't worry, it's going to be in the show notes on hustleshare.com. And lastly, if you want to be part of our community, it's going to be this Hustle Share community on Facebook. Again, Jawen and Camille, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ron.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Ron. It's been fun.
All right. And I'll see you guys in the next episode. Peace.